You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of A Chan of Heart by Evgenia Peretz. Max's birth coincided with the unveiling of CZI, which shook the philanthropy world. At its founding, the couple wrote a public letter to their new baby that both spoke of the promise of science and was suffused with Obama-era feel-good progressivism. Our hopes for your generation focus on two ideas, advancing human potential and promoting equality, they wrote. Promoting equality is about making sure everyone has access to these opportunities, regardless of nation, families, or circumstances they are born into. They announced they would be giving away 99% of their shares in Facebook in their lifetime, then valued at $45 billion, to the organization. The mission was to fix almost everything. On the science front, CZI would help cure, prevent, and manage all disease over the next century. To Corey Bargman, the first CZI head of science, that audacious goal was a meeting of the couple's essences. Zuckerberg, the big-thinking engineer, and Chan, the pediatrician, driven to find the often elusive answers to ailments afflicting young patients. She was really motivated by this idea to help children, says Bargman. And there were just children you could not help, because there was no help. And for her, science is hope. CZI zeroed in on the goal of creating a human cell atlas, a reference for understanding every single cell in the human body, of which there are 37 trillion. CZI wouldn't just make grants, it would also create tech tools and form its own biohubs. Research centers, bringing together scientists at the top universities. According to Sam Hawgood, Chancellor of UCSF and a CZI Biohub Network board member, CZI's big-picture goal set it apart from other biomedical philanthropies that might focus on a single disease. The great thing is their recognition that big breakthroughs in health come from long-term investments in fundamental, curiosity-driven science, Hawgood says. Next photos, April 2024. Chan and Zuckerberg attend the UFC 300 event at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. January 2025. Chan, Zuckerberg, Lauren Sanchez, Jeff Bezos, Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, and Elon Musk, among other dignitaries, at the second inauguration of President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. On the promoting equality front, they would remake public education and take on immigration and criminal justice reform, housing, and community. They laid out their ethos to baby Max. If you fear you'll go to prison rather than college because of the color of your skin, or that your family will be deported because of your legal status, or that you may be a victim of violence because of your religion, sexual orientation, or gender identity, then it's difficult to reach your full potential. It was personal to Chan, who would run the day-to-day operations, while Zuckerberg would advise. She had been lucky, she often said, to have had teachers who believed in her and nurtured her. But it was fundamentally unjust that people needed luck to have access to opportunities. T-shirts were made, a future for everyone. Scientists, nonprofit types, and left-leaning politicos flocked to work for them, like Obama advisor David Plouffe, who would run the Justice and Opportunity Initiative, and Jim Shelton, who worked at the Obama Education Department and came on to lead CZI's education initiative. It was like their beloved West Wing, but set at a charitable endeavor with limitless funds. The office, a single open space in downtown Menlo Park, was casual and non-hierarchical, a tone set by Chan, early employees recall. Even though she had some security measures in place for herself, She was approachable. Her desk was out in the open, and she chatted like any regular employee about kids, the martial arts class she was taking, pop culture. The couple made concerted efforts to bring staff into the fold to ask whatever they wanted in a weekly all-hands meeting. Chan, in particular, was an active listener. Maurice Wilkins, who was head of DEI until he left in 2019, recalls, "It's not like she was a critical race theory expert, any of that stuff, but she always took the posture of, 'All right, I'm willing to learn, and I want to do the right thing.' She seemed very genuine about wanting to get it right." And she pushed herself further, opening her own CZI-funded school with the late educator Meredith Liu for the most underserved children of East Palo Alto near Facebook's first offices. It was called the Primary School, and it would focus on the whole child, integrating health, social-emotional learning, SEL, and family support. Akemi Gibson, at the time a vice president at Sesame Street Workshop, which consulted with the school on SEL, recalls, "She spoke emphatically and passionately about the relationship between health, education, and poverty." The tech boom in Palo Alto had driven real estate prices up, forcing an exodus of poor and working-class people. According to Gibson, "It was clear she was aware of our concern about the reputation of Facebook displacing families, as many families were vulnerable, living in cars or their vans and with little resources. Still, CZI insisted to people inside and outside the organization that it ran independently of Facebook. Staffers understood that they shouldn't get too bent out of shape by, say, learning that Zuckerberg had met with Trump." There was a lot of grace for Priscilla, says Ray Meadows, formerly Holgado, a former grants manager in CZI's Justice and Opportunity Division. "I think folks gave her the benefit of the doubt for a long time. But with a shared CEO and Zuckerberg, it was increasingly hard for many to escape the sense that Facebook loomed over everything, especially when things started going sideways." Next photo, March 2025. Chan on stage at a featured session, A Future Without Disease, a conversation on shaping the next era of science with AI at South by Southwest in Austin. In 2018, CZI had to contend with the fallout from the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the revelation that a Trump-aligned political consulting firm had gathered data from 87 million Facebook users without their consent and targeted them with personalized ads prior to the 2016 election. Zuckerberg was dragged before Congress for the first time, where he was grilled not just about the company's privacy practices, but about the platform's addictive nature and how it was coarsening the public discourse and contributing to ethnic violence, particularly in Myanmar, where a genocide was taking place. Senator Lindsey Graham took him to task for the company's 2016 internal memo written by then-Vice President of Facebook Andrew Bosworth, subject line The Ugly, that read in part, "We connect people, period. That can be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs someone a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. And still, we connect people. The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good." Zuckerberg came through with what was widely regarded as a slap-on-the-wrist fine for Facebook. A few days later, he was even some $1 billion richer. But his reputation was bruised, and some at CZI worried that its image would be bruised by association and that CZI needed to work harder to distinguish itself from Facebook. That work appeared to fall to Chan, who shied away from the spotlight, but now seemed to take on a more robust role as the friendly public face of the organization. She went on CNN, for example, where she emphasized that the company was majority women, as B-roll showed women in a conference room laughing. On the Today Show in 2020, She took the opportunity to come to her husband's defense. Seeing him at home and in his work, grappling with these massive questions that sometimes don't have clear answers, she said, "I am proud of how he's been handling all of this, and I know he's doing his hardest, and I wish others could see it." A CZI spokesperson says that Cambridge Analytica had no impact on Priscilla's role at CZI, which has always been to serve as the day-to-day leader of the organization, including speaking publicly about CZI's work. But more controversy was brewing behind the scenes at Facebook that cut ever closer to the bone of part of Chan's life's work, children's health. In 2019 and 2020, Facebook's internal research demonstrated that its app Instagram was harming teenagers, with conclusions such as, "We make body images worse for 1 in 3 teen girls," and teens blame Instagram for increases in the rate of anxiety and depression. Another finding stated that among teenagers with suicidal thoughts, 13% of British teens and 6% of American teens traced those feelings to Instagram. Until Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen leaked to the Wall Street Journal in 2021 in what became part of the paper's series The Facebook Files, the news had not made its way to the public. Zuckerberg, Haugen later testified, had been reluctant to take the steps necessary to address the problem. More safety meant less time on the platform and thus fewer ad dollars. The Facebook Files will be the basis for Aaron Sorkin's upcoming follow-up to The Social Network, which he will also direct. A representative for Sorkin did not respond to Vanity Fair as to whether Chan will be depicted. Prior to the scandal breaking, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt was studying social media and its adverse effect on kids for his future book, 2024's groundbreaking The Anxious Generation, and got to know the couple. Chan admired him so much for his previous book, The Coddling of the American Mind, that she invited him to dinner with her and Zuckerberg. A source close to the couple points out that Mark and Priscilla regularly invite people from all different backgrounds to visit and share their perspective. Zuckerberg indicated that he disagreed that there was any causal relationship between social media and mental health, and insisted there was no scientific consensus on the matter. Later, Meta would lobby against the bipartisan Kids Online Safety Act, while Haidt would comment that Zuckerberg does bear some personal responsibility for a spike in suicides among children who used Facebook's apps. Chan, it seemed, took her husband's side on the matter. In 2020, when asked on the Today Show about social media platforms and how parents can protect their children, she replied, "With everything where there is physical danger or threats to their mental health, you teach them how to use it, use something safely. As a parent, I also need tools. You might be looking at their social media, or whatever it might look like. We need to monitor, have a gradual release, and expect tools to help us along the way." In other words, parents should police what their kids are seeing on Facebook, not the company, as if parents could possibly regulate the all-powerful algorithm. In the summer of 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, Facebook's controversial actions came crashing through the doors of CZI. In response to the protest, Trump had posted on Facebook, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Despite public outcry to stop Trump's incitement of violence, Zuckerberg and his team at Facebook made the decision to keep it up. More than 140 CZI-funded scientists wrote a letter to Zuckerberg, arguing that Facebook had violated its own guidelines and that the spread of deliberate misinformation and divisive language is directly antithetical to CZI's stated mission. Chan and Zuckerberg responded with a statement stressing that CZI was separate from Facebook and that it remained committed to an inclusive, just, and healthy future for everyone. But that didn't contain the matter. nor did Chan's emotional promise to the staff over Zoom that she and Zuckerberg stood with the black community. A question was asked about Zuckerberg stoking the flames of racial violence on Facebook, and Chan tried to assure them, again, that we are two separate organizations. But I want you to know that Mark feels very similarly to how I do about the current situation. In a subsequent Zoom meeting soon after, Zuckerberg joined Chan, and staffers' complaints snowballed. One after another, they gave emotional pleas, expressing their feeling that he had betrayed the company's values. One said she was losing sleep over decisions Facebook was making. Another went so far as to ask Zuckerberg if he would consider stepping down from either CZI or Facebook. He seemed unfazed by this. "We believe that black lives matter and that it's important to say that, and I have said that," he told them. "We also need to get through this moment in a way where we have our values intact going forward. And for me, a lot of what that means in a democracy is supporting giving people a voice, even when you do not like what they say." Chan tried to remind people yet again that the work CZI was doing had nothing to do with her co-founder's other job. "This is not what we work on at CZI," she said. "The collective mission at CZI is what I want to lead us to go charge at." But the message no longer seemed to fly. A scientist pressed Zuckerberg about who exactly was making content decisions at Facebook and how. In response, Zuckerberg tried to assure the group that the company's automated systems were on top of it. "Making sure we're proactive about reducing harm on the platform is a huge priority," he said. "There are about 20 categories of harm that we track." His responses really felt like an insult to the intelligence of CZI employees, recalls Reynoso, the former CZI engineer, who says she was one of the more confrontational people on the Zoom. "I would have rather him come out and just say he was letting Trump flout Facebook's rules out of political expediency." In reaction to what they were hearing and wanting to be part of the Black Lives Matter efforts, the couple announced that CZI would make a $500 million commitment to leaders and organizations that supported racial equity. It would launch, for example, a partnership with four historically black medical colleges and a science diversity leadership program to fund historically underrepresented faculty in biomedical services. As the couple wrote in its annual letter that year, "We started CZI because we believe everyone deserves the chance to reach their full potential. But systemic barriers have long denied many black, indigenous, and Latinx people that chance." In line with this awareness, when COVID hit, CZI stepped up with large-scale testing, particularly in underserved areas of California. "The legacy systems just weren't ready to do that," says Bargman. At the same time, however, there seemed to be growing concern over political optics, according to multiple former staffers, so much so that the communications department was one of the approving parties for grantees. A CZI spokesperson says, "Like in any other organization, communications is a strategic function whose work is wholly in service of our programmatic goals. Final decisions about programmatic grants are made by the respective leaders of our initiatives in alignment with strategy." Meadows recalls that his team would sit in front of a whiteboard where grantees were classified by left, right, and center. "If we fund the ACLU, then we have to fund Y, meaning a Y factor, not the YMCA. We knew we had to offset things constantly," is how he characterizes the thinking. "We're not looking at these things and asking what the best solution is. We're looking at what's going to rock the boat the least, and in my mind, won't disrupt Facebook's business interest." Meadows left the company in September 2020, and shortly after filed a racial discrimination complaint against CZI. CZI responded that the claims were previously raised internally independently investigated and found to be unsubstantiated. Indeed, Chan and Zuckerberg drew criticism for donating some $400 million for safe voting booth infrastructure during the pandemic, even as Facebook became a prominent platform for spreading anti-vaccine conspiracy theories. Republicans, claiming that the donation was a partisan effort to help get to help get Democrats elected, called the donation Zuckerbucks, and Trump blamed Zuckerberg for helping Biden win the 2020 election. Other billionaires might have laughed off the complaints, but Chan and Zuckerberg scrambled to change tack. In 2021, after rebranding Facebook as Meta, the couple hired Brian Baker, a prominent Republican strategist, to seemingly help repair relations with Trump and his allies. They publicly announced that the voting infrastructure donation was always intended to be a one-time thing and that they had no plans to repeat it. And they took their first baby steps away from work that had the whiff of activism. Starting in 2021, CZI spun off its work in criminal justice and immigration into two separate organizations, the Just Trust and FWD.us. 2 years later, they wound down education advocacy, shifting its focus in that arena to AI. The moves were subtle, but among its idealistic staffers, something was getting lost, and Chan was harder to reach. According to one, in meetings, she seemed to be deferring to Zuckerberg more and more, and folks began asking one another every day, "Who has Priscilla's ear?" And then Trump was back. In the lead-up to the 2024 election, Zuckerberg had been confronting an FTC lawsuit for allegedly maintaining an illegal monopoly, a suit that could force Meta to break up and potentially knock down his estimated $207 billion net worth. He tried to stave it off with a settlement, but was unsuccessful. Now, following Trump's victory, CZI staffers watched with dismay as their co-founder steadily made his MAGA transformation. From his invitation to Dana White, UFC CEO and Trump pal, to sit on the board of Meta, to his announcement that Meta would rid itself of fact-checkers, to showing up on Joe Rogan's podcast, sporting his new Manosphere look. The comment to Rogan that the workplace could use some more masculine energy particularly rankled. At least one person wondered how Chan could have abided it. According to another source, when a question was raised at CZI about Meta's $1 million contribution to Trump's inauguration, the response came down, "That's Meta's prerogative, and it has nothing to do with CZI." Curiously, however, the moves CZI then took were precisely in line with what Zuckerberg needed to remain in good favor with the current administration. CZI stopped funding the two social justice organizations it had spun off 4 years earlier. In January, after Meta announced that it would end DEI hiring practices, CZI assured worried staffers that decisions made at Meta would have no impact. But a few weeks later, after Trump issued an executive order targeting DEI, CZI followed suit, closing its DEI team too. Dozens of grantees' plans for the future have been thwarted. Buttoning up that entire era, the primary school announced it would be shuttering, a CZI investment that had once been celebrated for lifting up the most underserved children of the community. CZI said it would donate $50 million to the community, in part to assist impacted families. A source with knowledge of the situation says that the school had no endowment and had failed to scale, which was part of its original goal. In May, the editor-in-chief of Inside Philanthropy, David Callahan, wrote, "I can't recall another mega donor couple backtracking so completely from their early ambition." Former DEI head Maurice Wilkins has watched with dismay as Chan's foundational passion to take luck out of the equation seems to have fizzled. That idea has completely disappeared, he claims. And so my assumption is that they decided that they want to do what's in the best interest of remaining the richest people in the world. Reynoso, the former CZI engineer, echoes that view. By the time she left, it felt like Chan was serving the purpose of helping Zuckerberg launder his wealth into prestige. It felt like we were becoming a place where any benefit to wider society was a secondary effect. This has all necessitated something of a public rebrand for CZI, which involves downplaying the promoting equality thing. The idea once central in their letter to Max was not that important in the first place. When asked in March about CZI's turn from some social issues by an interviewer at South by Southwest, Chan said, "I want to note that we've honored all of our existing commitments," and added, "The reality at CZI is that these policy changes affect a very small percentage of our overall work." In June, she addressed the criticism more directly in a letter on CZI's website. "I'm still guided by the same values I've lived by my entire life and that I work every day to pass on to my daughters. Optimism for a better future, hard work to make that future possible, and a deep commitment to helping others. The changes we've made at CZI will allow us to ensure our work does the most good and achieves the greatest possible impact." Chan has done what she felt she had to do, according to sources who know her intimately. "I think at the end of the day, they are both practical people," is how one close friend puts it. Another source close to Chan says of her choice to attend the inauguration, "Turning discoveries in basic science research into treatments and cures that impact millions of people requires deep partnership with the federal government and private industry." Like many executives, Priscilla sees value in engaging with leaders in both parties and across sectors to advance CZI's mission. According to CZI BioHub Network board member Hawgood, progress has been made in the Human Cell Atlas. The next step in its migration would be to build digital cells for scientists to study. That would require AI to process multitudes of data sets. It's too soon to tell if what CZI calls the virtual cell model will one day come to fruition. If it could be achieved, it would be a breakthrough along the lines of the Human Genome Project, or something of that magnitude, says Hawgood. Gates, whose own foundation has collaborated with CZI over the years, praises CZI for accelerating open, collaborative biomedical research and putting AI tools in the hands of scientists, and believes that its impacts, that its achievements, will have lasting impact. In July, CZI announced the opening of a new center in partnership with Nobel Prize-winning biochemist Jennifer Doudna to treat rare genetic diseases in children using CRISPR gene editing therapies. Yet the Trump administration is eviscerating the ecosystem of science on which CZI relies. Trump's budget called for an $18 billion cut in the NIH budget, threatening biomedical research across the country. The administration has already canceled or frozen grants for roughly 2,500 projects tackling cancer, Alzheimer's, and chronic diseases. The best young minds from China, India, and any other foreign country may not be allowed to attend Harvard, Chan's alma mater. Two board members of the CZI BioHub Network are sounding the alarm, albeit diplomatically. University of Chicago President Paul Alavastos, a distinguished nanoscientist who joined the board in 2023, explains, "I think we've had for decades now a kind of compact between the public, the universities, biotech companies, medical companies, large academic medical centers, and also foundations and nonprofits. We've had a kind of compact where we all contribute in different ways to what has been really the most successful biomedical discovery that the world has ever known. And I think it's very precious, he says. Hoggood echoes the sense of urgency. An $18 billion cut and a $47 billion NIH would be devastating. Not just devastating to a place like UCSF, says Hoggood. My greater concern is that it's going to be a threat to the U.S. dominating the world in science going forward. Now is the time for advocacy. Might the couple participate in such advocacy themselves? Hoggood says, I think they're making a statement in where they're putting their own money, and that is into the fundamental science. In terms of what they do from a political advocacy perspective, it's not my role to tell them what to do or even suggest to them. It's just as it is my personal decision, what I do. I respect their privacy and their own decision making on that subject. A Sacred Pause by Keziah Weir. In 1928, Coco Chanel conjured her Riviera getaway into being, complete with artist friends, lavender fields, and a clay court worthy of Roland Garros. Following a magnificent restoration of La Pausa, as the property is known, a new book explores the house's vibrant history. In the photos, a tree grows in Roxbrunn-Cap-Martin. Gabrielle Chanel lounges in the center of her olive tree with friends François Hugo, Maria Ruspoli Hugo, and their son, and Audrey Field and Pierre Coll. In a world of struggle, of rain, of mud, of gray steel, the French author and diplomat Paul Morant wrote of the Côte d'Azur in a 1929 article for this magazine, "It is the one region which strives to guard, in a softening air, the secret of doing nothing and the sweetness of living nobly, that is to say, idly and slowly." The year prior, the writer, who had a villa in Villefranche-sur-Mer, dubbed Lingerie, gained a new Riviera neighbor in Gabrielle Chanel. The 45-year-old couturier, who would ironically later describe her clientele to Morant as busy women, had purchased herself a slice of this Gallic paradise, a 1911 bungalow in the craggy hills of Roquebrune-Cap-Martin. The top of the regional portmanteau being, Morant wrote, an old fortified village where red and yellow houses, like pimento trees, are rooted in the rocks among lemon and orange trees, and the bottom filled with silver olive trees, with the last homes of millionaires. By Chanel's arrival, the Riviera was a well-established hotbed of creative idyll, a place where Pablo Picasso rendered the ink heiress Sarah Murphy, and F. Scott Fitzgerald hunted unsuccessfully for Edith Wharton. Hoping to discuss his work in progress, The Great Gatsby. Though it was royalty rather than artistry that had cemented the region's status as the place to be. The extravagant Excelsior Hotel Regina, which loomed above Nice, was built in the last gasp of the 19th century with 400 bedrooms and 233 baths, so that Queen Victoria, who vacationed there for more than a dozen years, might accommodate the large entourage of the Empress of India. In its wake, grand homes, Florentine revivals, Moorish villas, Tudor cottages popped up in the surrounding towns and communes, like the violets and primroses that dotted their hillsides each spring. Next photos, a view of the La Pausa facade during construction, circa 1929. Photographer Roger Schall with Chanel, 1938. A promotional poster for the Riviera highlights the Blue Train, the colloquial name for the Calais to Mediterranean Express, and Chanel in the lavender, 1938. Chanel bought the pink bungalow, called La Pausa, the Pause, by its first owners, the writers Alice Muriel and Charles Norris Williamson, and promptly tore it down. In its stead, she hired for the sole building project of her career the architect Robert Streitz to create a three-story, 15,000-square-foot manor home with a sober off-white facade and gridded windows and walkways that call to mind her iconic quilted bags. But she did keep an enormous olive tree sprawling at the entrance, and the name. La Pausa, the ideal Mediterranean villa of Gabrielle Chanel, captures the story of the house and its environs. Its publication, overseen by Jana Peel, Chanel's President of Arts, Culture, and Heritage, corresponds with the completion of a 5-year restoration of the house, helmed by longtime Chanel architect Peter Marino. Published by Flammarion and printed in Verona, its book as Objet d'Art, with a cloth cover, the kind of cobalt blue, found 100 yards off the Mediterranean coast, or splashed on a cathedral ceiling, and end papers precision matched to La Pausa's shutters. This shade, like a cloudless sky in midsummer, at once natural and electric, and over which Marino agonized, is so custom that Pantone doesn't recognize it. Between these blues nestle more than 500 photographs and collected ephemera, deco posters advertising the Riviera's soigné pleasures, sketches of Chanel made by friends and lovers, major artistic works by members of her social set, her architect's bills from a garden center in Mentone, and a landscape designer in Nice, a loose-leaf reproduction of the house blueprint. Peel tells me that she spent a year thinking about the colors that would best capture what she calls the sense of the south of France, drawing from a limited palette of whites and greens and dusty purple pulled from the house's tones and the region's natural fauna and fields of lavender. Chanel was nothing if not enigmatic, but the house, a highly personal project that teemed with life under her stewardship, offers an intimate glimpse of the self-made artisan who revolutionized the way women dress. Her primary inspiration, for instance, the Cistercian Abbey of Aubusine in the forested Corrèze region where she had lived as a child after her mother's death and father's abandonment. Much later, instead of describing those sterile times, writes Helene Fulgence, Chanel's head of heritage sites, she would reweave the truth into an ever-shifting legend. When it came time to build her own home, she wove her memories of the abbey into Streitz's architectural plans, describing Aubusine's enormous staircase, worn down by the monk's footsteps. The resulting home, as Marino said to Peel in a conversation that introduces the book, couldn't look more like a convent if you stood on your head and spit nickels. Despite its monastic ties, the house was a labor of romantic love. You could say she did the house for the Duke of Westminster, Peel noted to Marino of Chanel's longtime paramour. She made for him a beautiful ceruced oak paneled room, and then made for herself a bed with a shining star on top of it, and then a mirrored bathroom. When the relationship ended, Chanel reassigned his bedroom to her self-described only woman friend, Misia Sert, the Russian-born social maven who'd helped the designer gain entree into Côte d'Azur society, and patron and muse to such artists as Bonnard, Toulouse-Lautrec, Vuillard, and Renoir. The Vogue editor Bettina Wilson, after a stay at La Pausa, suggested that one of Chanel's great skills was to surround herself with intelligent people the better to shine, writes Flavia Frigeri, Chanel curator for the collection at London's National Portraits Gallery. Whether Chanel was so calculating is hard to say, but what is certain is that she chose to surround herself with creative figures. The house became a hub of avant-garde intelligentsia. The novelist Colette lived nearby, and guests of La Pausa included Franco Zeffirelli, Gala and Salvador Dali, and Jean Cocteau, the latter of whom Chanel gave his own small house on the property. It became a place of artistic percolation and relaxation, of tree climbing, buffet lunches, and photo shoots, in which Chanel's spotted Great Dane, Gigot, often took center stage. Chanel and others in her set made their way to La Pausa via the Calais to Mediterranean Express, where Gabrielle Chanel herself might have just been entertaining Dali or Cocteau. Marino, who previously restored Chanel's vineyards at Chateau Rosanceyla and Chateau Canon, consulted hundreds of photos of Chanel at La Pausa. The only contemporary intrusions, per Marino's account to Peel, modern air conditioning, plumbing, and electricity. Peel and her team have restocked the tranquil library with more than 1,000 volumes. Sourced from 7L, the Parisian bookstore founded by Karl Lagerfeld, and Hachard's, the Piccadilly shop founded in 1797, at which the Duke of Westminster was once a frequent patron, that include the travel books written by La Pausa's first owners, tomes by guests like Dali and Reverdy, as well as contemporary fiction and works on dance, gardens, and art. Much of Chanel's original furniture and decor remains, including a sunburst-rimmed clock, though the carpets, having withstood years of visitors and constant rolling up for guests to dance, were in tatters, Peel says, and had to be recreated. Chanel kept two huge monstrous cacti on the staircase, which tower over Gala and Salvador Dali in one 1938 photograph. "We bought two little ones from the botanical garden that we have grown for 3 years," Marino told Peel. Still, when the book went to press, they remained small enough to fit on a windowsill. "We're desperate. They're terribly slow growing. For now, a stately pair of Euphorbia candelabrum cacti grown in Spain stand in their stead." Next photos, who's who. W. Somerset Maugham called the Riviera a sunny place for shady people, but it was also home to writers and royals alike. F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald rented the house that's now Hotel Bellerive. The Excelsior was built to house Queen Victoria's large entourage. And there's a map that shows photos of and locations of Hotel Bellerive's Juan Le Pin, Gerald and Sarah Murphy's Villa America, Antibes, the Excelsior Hotel, Regina, Nice, Paul Morin's L'Orangerie, Villefranche-sur-Mer, Eileen Martin's E1027, Roquebrune, Cap Martin, La Pausa, Baroness de Rothschild's Villa Effrochy, Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat. Streitz's drawing of the north facade of La Pausa, 1929. Chanel in the La Pausa Cloister, 1938. Churchill's view of Menton from La Pausa, 1957. A La Pausa Butler, 1938. Chanel and Gigot, 1930. And invoice from the Establissement Horticole Regina, August 1929. The house had its soft relaunch this summer during Art Basel with a private dinner and slate of performances. Boris Charmatz, artistic director of the company Tanztheater Wuppertal Pina Bausch, performed a dance on the tennis court. The musician Alice Smith inaugurated the piano. Diana Picasso, the painter's granddaughter, was in attendance. This fall, a group of four writers chosen by the critic Merv Emmer will take up temporary residence at the house in a writer's retreat. "Fashion does not exist only in dresses," Chanel once told Morin. "Fashion is in the air. It is born on the wind. You can sense it. You can breathe it. It's in the sky and on the highway. It's everywhere. It has to do with ideas, with social mores, with events. It lives on in her house, and its restoration and reinvigoration is all an effort, in a very humble way," Peel says, "to bring back some of this energy." The Calais to Mediterranean Express was a stylish train with steel-blue carriages, luxurious sleeping suites, and René Lalique-molded glass panels. The rail line was such an iconic aspect of the world of the Riviera, the Cocteau took its affectionate nickname for the title of his insouciant 1924 one-act ballet, Le Train Bleu, which poked gentle fun at the Côte d'Azur C and B scene leisure class, and for which Chanel designed the costumes, from the golf shoes to the tennis skirts and swimsuits. 2 years earlier, Cocteau had commissioned Chanel to create costumes for his adaptation of Antigone, telling one interviewer, "I couldn't imagine the daughters of Oedipus being badly dressed." The ballet premiered at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, Paris, produced by ballet russe impresario Sergei Diaghilev, choreography by Bronislava Nijinska, and a stage curtain created by Picasso, featuring two breast-bared figures cavorting under a deep blue sky. The historical arm of the House of Chanel has been involved in a painstaking recreation of the costumes, and a restoration of Picasso's 36-foot tapestry, Two Women Running on the Beach, The Race, which is now on view to the public for the first time in a century at London's V&A East Storehouse. Next photos, a memory book page from a 1938 Audrey Field album signed by La Pausa visitors, including Chanel, Coco, Pierre Cole, Salvador and Gala Dali, and Pierre Reverdy. Winston Churchill on the La Pausa grounds in the 1950s. Robert Streitz's ground floor plan of La Pausa. Stage curtain for Le Train Bleu Ballet, based on a painting by Pablo Picasso. Salvador Dali on the La Pausa staircase, 1938. A floral invoice, 1930. Dali in the garden, fall 1938. Dali's apparition of face and fruit dish on a beach, 1938. The cloisters at Aubusson. Christian Berard's drawing of Chanel, circa 1930s. In 1935, while visiting Chanel at La Pausa, Chanel's lover, Paul Eribe, suffered a fatal heart attack during a game of tennis, a tragedy that presaged a period darkened by loss and wartime. Gabrielle Palace-Labrunie, Chanel's great niece, is quoted in the book, recalling the summer of 1938, "I have an image fixed in my head of Coco and her friends, Pierre Reverdy, Maria de Gramont, Salvador Dali and his wife Gala, all clustered around the radio, stupefied and petrified as they listened to the voice of Hitler. Dali was at the house, in fact, to paint what would become his unsellable psychosexual nightmare, the enigma of Hitler. Chanel herself would slip back into the shadows during the war, and that part of her legacy remains murky to this day. She attempted to use the Aryan laws to gain control of rights to Chanel No. 5 and was reportedly assigned the code name Westminster during her role in Operation Muddlehut, a harebrained effort by a rogue Nazi commander to negotiate a separate peace treaty between Britain and Germany. But archival materials from a 2023 London exhibition have also suggested she worked with the resistance. After the war, she visited La Pausa less and less often. It held perhaps too many ghosts. In 1953, when she sold the house to Emery Reeves, the writer, publisher, and literary agent to Winston Churchill, she included the entirety of its contents in the sale, from her furniture to her photographs. 10 years ago, the fashion house of Chanel purchased the home from the French company SCI La Pausa. 5 years later, restorations began. It was very much about the precision of reenactment, Peel says, bringing this back exactly to a moment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.